All right, hello all, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, coming to you from WHPC 90.3 FM, Nassau Community College in Garden City, New York. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, here every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6 p.m., and with me, of course, my lovely wife, co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan.
I'm waving at you.
Hi, babe. I'm so happy it's Friday.
Me too.
I'm happy to be here to cover how music changed. It's something that we do every Friday when we look at some of the most important aspects of music culture from the past 100 years and focus on the artists and the events that made music change in our lifetimes. And we have been, for the past few weeks now, focusing on what is part 14 of our series, which is the music of Bix Beiderbecke. Now, up to this point, we have done three shows covering Bix's music. We started somewhere around the middle of 1924, and we got as far as 1927. So we really did about, on average, about a year per show. Today's show, we're going to do our best to condense the balance of his career into one show, which is incredible. But this is the arc of Bix's career. It's a slow rise, and then there's this even...
There's a cliff.
A precipitous cliff, which is just marked, though, with a tremendous amount of recordings. Just for example, like this, here's a fact. The 70 sides that Bix recorded before 1928 would amount to only one-third of all of those on which he would be featured over the course of his career. So technically, we've still got two-thirds of his career to cover as far as music goes.
Uh-huh.
However, pretty much all has already been said, or nearly all, by the point of 1927 ending. Bix's moments of grace would return here and there, and he would keep a remarkable musical instinct and a perfect mastery of the difficult art of expressing much in a short solo, but he would never again regain the freshness, the spontaneity, and for once, the word is justified, the genius that drives most of the recordings he cut in 1927. That's a direct quote from the book by Jean-Pierre Léon called Bix, The Definitive Biography of a Jazz Legend. The fact is, this is a classic rise and fall fable told in Fast Forward in today's show, in an era that was decades before this was a cliché. Before we knew that rock stars could be dying of various overdoses or because of the things that alcohol could do, Bix more or less was the stereotype. More than the stereotype, he was the prototype for what this actually was. Let's figure out. By 1928, it's a new year. And it begins with Bix as a member of the Whiteman Orchestra. He's there with Frank Trambauer, of course, who is also a big feature of what this series is about. And the orchestra is busier than it had ever been around this time, especially in regard to recording. They were ending an 8-year contract that they had with Victor, and they had signed with Columbia. So contract fulfillment recordings were happening at an extraordinary pace. In fact, in the next 4 months, Bix would take part in so many recordings that it almost equals his entire previous career up until this point. If you saw it on paper, you wouldn't believe it. You could go page after page. It just seems like every few days they're back into the recording studio recording even more songs. Well, in the beginning, Bix took part in a lot of these recordings, and he still sounds like he's doing pretty well. Let's hear one of these recordings from early 1928 by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. Here's a track called Lonely Melody.
Thank you. track called Lonely Melody. It's by the credited to the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Now, naturally, what you're hearing there mostly is what today sounds like a pretty standard big band arrangement, and not very much about it that is incredible. The reason I played it is because there's a nice solo in there that Bix plays, and what's interesting about it is that there are two versions of this track that exist, and it shows you just how Bix was working in the Whiteman Orchestra, because usually, especially around this time, people who were playing solos, even the hot players, they'd work out their bits ahead of time. They'd have a pretty darn good idea of what they were going to play when their time slot came. So they'd work it out, they'd rehearse it, and the various takes would show them playing pretty much the same solo.
Variations of a theme.
Right, pretty much variations of the same solo, basically. The two takes with Bix, they're totally different ideas. He's absolutely ad-libbing it the entire time, from beginning to end, and he's formulating these really nice ideas that are really fully formed ideas. And as much as that's a plus for Bix, it's actually working against him, because now he's working in the Whiteman Orchestra. There's other trumpeters in the band, a significant number of other trumpeters who have been there longer than him, and they read brilliantly. And the fact that Bix doesn't read brilliantly is making him feeling very uncomfortable in his spot. Even though he's taking these great, brilliant solos,
he's got an inferiority complex.
He's got it, right, which is compounded by the fact that the other trumpeters are looking a little bit jealous at him, like, why is he getting to take these solos? And he doesn't even know how to read properly.
Right.
So there's some tension there. But at this point, at least, his position is, you know, he's in a nice, strong position, and he's a featured artist with the Whiteman Orchestra. And a lot of credit has got to be given to Paul Whiteman, because at this point, already it's obvious that Bix is a bit of a problem. He's drinking way too much. He's having trouble at some of the sessions that he's playing at. He's having health issues at this point. He's actually having trouble walking for whatever's happening with the booze that he's taken into him. It's now settling in his knees. And there's times when he feels that he needs to get around on crutches. And the guy's 26 years old at this point.
Wow.
He's incredibly young, but he's beginning to take on like the body of a 70-year-old man. But Whiteman stands by him and as time will tell, continues to stand by him and does everything he can to try to help Bix. But there's not much you can do for a man who doesn't want to help himself. But that's eventually where the story goes.
At this point,
he's there right in the orchestra, right alongside Bix, doing what he can. He's being his friend, but Bix isn't somebody who is easily known. So all that Frank can do is stand by him. So he does. And let's play another track from the same era when things are still seeming to go fairly well with Bix and the Whiteman Orchestra. More of an upbeat track. Also, we can hear some of the interplay with Frank and Bix on this song. This is called San, S-A-N. Thank you. some really nice unison trumpet work there, where there's the trumpet break in the middle of there. That's Bix Beiderbecke, who's actually playing with two other guys. That's Charlie Margulis is playing with him in harmony, and Jimmy Dorsey as well, playing a part along with Bix on that track. That's about as close to jazz as the Paul Whiteman Orchestra would get with a track like that. But that was, you know, enough to make Bix happy, because at least there was some of that, because this wasn't what the orchestra was always about. The other thing that was giving him some pleasure was the fact that every now and then he could also play with Frank's group, because when Paul Whiteman wasn't busy, then Frank Trumbauer would put his own group together. So they had gone into the studio just a week after this had happened. And what was really nice about it is that they were able to get Bing Crosby to come with them.
Nice.
So this is Frank Trumbauer's group with Bing Crosby on vocal. And it's kind of interesting because you actually hear Frank and Bing together on this track doing like a joint vocal back and forth.
Uh-huh.
It's something that Bing later forgot that he had ever done. And it took, like, they had to remind him, like, actually present him with the evidence of it. And he's like, oh, I guess I did sing with Frank. And this is Bing's quote about it. I had a lot of nerve in those days. Me singing with Tram, I should have been arrested. There was a pub, a bistro on 48th or 49th, just off Broadway, where all the guys went. The one quality the place had was a piano on the balcony. Bix and all the rest would play and exchange ideas on the piano. With all the noise going on, I don't know how they heard themselves, but they did. I didn't contribute anything, but I listened and I learned. I was now being influenced by these musicians, particularly horn men. I could hum and sing all of the jazz choruses from the recordings made by Bix and the rest. Bix, Bill Chalice, even Frankie Trombauer would make suggestions to me for my vocalizing, and I'd give it a try. After all, these were the giants of our day, and they knew their music. Here they are getting together, song credited to Frankie Trombauer and his orchestra. Here's their version of Mississippi Mud.
Singing, yeah.
You just get a load of this on you.
La-di-di-da-da-da-da. Oh, is that it?
Well, that's part of it. That's the prelude. Now we sing. When the sun goes down, the tide goes out, the darkies gather round and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Doug.
Oh, you mean your old Uncle Doug down on home there with his feet in the mud.
I don't mean Uncle Doug's pappy and his feet's really in the mud. And what a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you, they don't need no band. They keep time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as a cow chewing on a cud when the darkies beat their feet on the Mississippi mud.
Time by clapping their hands, just as happy as a cow chewing on a cud when the darkies beat the feet.
So you done jumped up and got me beating my feet.
If the darkies beat the feet on the Mississippi mud.
About the only thing unfortunate about that recording is the semi-racist remarks of the lyrics, but you couldn't have, the year is 1928, so it's only natural, I suppose, at that time that nobody, it was obviously not meant with
I think people were just ignorant.
Yeah, it wasn't, there was no malintent there at all, I'm sure. Anyway, moving on, Bix, obviously, as you're hearing this, these tunes, I mean, he's still shining on the outside, and he's really well appreciated by Paul Whiteman in his position in the orchestra, and Frank is totally, you know, tickled to have him and be working with him regularly. He's still a big draw. He's the reason, if you know, people wanted to play like Bix. He's the white guy on trumpet that other white guys could emulate because he gave them hope to think that, okay, this, you know, jazz can maybe belong to white people too. It's possible that we can do something with this. But the excess schedule of recording that was going on was beginning to wear him down. Also, I'm skipping all of this, pretty much for obvious reasons, but the Whiteman Orchestra would also do a tremendous amount of like neoclassical pieces. Graffé, who was one of his arrangers, and he would write things like Three Shades of Blue and Metropolis. Gershwin would occasionally write some very serious pieces that they'd get the honor of presenting, things like Concerto in F. And a lot of this, with all the non-jazz arrangements, you know, combined with the excessive live work, would definitely start to take a toll on Bix. The seemingly endless series with Whiteman for the next 4 months, also basically with one reasonable session under Frankie Traumbauer's name, which you've just heard a track from it. And then, of course, was the very last recording session that was made under Bix's own name. We just jump forward a few months to the time of April 17th, 1928. Just a few months into it, and Bix still sounds like he's at the top of his game. But at this point, this is the last recording session you're going to hear that's really credited to Bix himself at this point. Already, you can probably listen to this track. You're going to hear that the swing and the spark of 1927 already seems like it's less bright. He's playing, but you can probably hear through the cracks on this a little bit.
The shine is off of it.
You tell me what you think. This is Bix, as I said, from the middle of 1927 with a track called Thou Swell.
Thank you.
with only one exception that came at the very end of his recording career. That was the last session credited to Bix Beiderbecke at this time.
Hmm.
And also what was happening right around this time, this is when the Columbia contract began to kick in with Paul Whiteman. So they got all the work done for RCA Victor. And actually, it's interesting because Fox Movietone had made a newsreel to, quote unquote, celebrate this for Paul Whiteman. And it ends up being the only footage that exists of Bix Beiderbecke. It's like he's on screen for about 15 seconds. They have this picture of the Whiteman Orchestra playing My Ohio Home, and Bix is on the screen to one side of the stage, just like if he was just like maybe 15 inches to one side, he wouldn't have even been in the shot.
Wow.
He just barely makes it into the shot. And he sits there, he plays for just a few seconds, he lifts his horn, you know, looks a little bit to the left and right, and then it's over and he's gone. And that's it. It's that... like quick, and it's like the story of Bix's life. Everything seems like it's a mystery, or it happens in a mist, almost
a flash.
As if it's not real.
And a puff of smoke, and it's gone.
Now, meanwhile, okay, so now there's a tremendous amount of work that's still going on. I must have flipped through 10, 15 pages here that I'm bypassing of recordings that are happening with the Whiteman Orchestra under Columbia, because Columbia, even then, much as it was during the rock and roll era, it was not that sort of a label. It didn't want to do jazz because it considered that to be, you know, they wanted to play what they considered to be commercial, popular, appealing music, broadly appealing music. So, and it was. The sides that Whiteman were recording at this point were incredibly popular, but they were definitely not jazz and only partially interesting from a historic perspective. And even regarding how they affected Bix, I mean, Bix at this point is usually in this role playing third trumpet, fourth trumpet. So there's no real need for us to be playing this as far as it's relative to Bix or Frank, because they are playing, you know, third or fourth rate roles with right. a lot of these songs. At one point, there is one session that is worth coming up. It's a reasonably good take by Bix, but it did not come without trouble. At this point, Bix's drinking is becoming really serious and it's affecting his playing. In fact, this track took 9 takes and 2 days for them to finally get one take that was useful. And that's pretty, in those days especially, this is not the days when anybody would normally go more than 2 takes. So for them to be going 9 takes in 1928 is pretty over the top. Now, the end results at least resemble jazz, and which was an oddity for Whiteman on Columbia Records at this time. And after all those takes, Bix finally does put together something which is cohesive. That's why it's worth hearing what he does here on this track called "Tain't So, Honey." Tain't So.
Hey, people, you should come to Arkansas. Meet a friend of mine, old Aunt Phoebe Law. She's known to everyone for miles around. She will help you when friends forsake you and troubles bear you down. For those who come her way are blessed when they hear her say, "Tain't so, honey, tain't so." Spoke to the Lord and the Lord said, "No, tain't so. Honey, tain't so." Tain't so, honey, tain't so. Tomorrow will bring something good, I know, tain't so. I mean, it just ain't so. Makes no difference what your problem may be. Just look up, brother, and I'm sure you will see. Tain't so, honey, tain't so. The devil said yes, but the Lord said no, tain't so. Honey, tain't so. Thank you.
quite a cohesive take. It does not, it belies the fact that there were eight other, you know, botched takes before it, because that really does shine. Really nice. The Big sounds great on that track. The thing is, like, the work doesn't let up. Just because he's had that trouble, it doesn't matter. The live performances and the things that they're scheduled to do just goes on and on and on. And they eventually end, had a very high, actually a high point in Bix's life in around October of 1928. It was actually a high point in Bix's life. And there was a show that was put on at Carnegie Hall, which was a celebration of Paul Whiteman's orchestra. And of course, they performed a great number of the classical pieces that they had been apparently obliged to do and were felt privileged to do with some of their jazzy numbers. But the high point for Bix was actually when they brought out a grand piano in the middle of all of this, and with all these other people who are playing, you know, a place where like where Rachmaninoff would have been seated at one point. Now mm-hmm. there's Bix sitting at a piano playing his composition In a Mist wow. at Carnegie Hall, which was obviously something that meant the world to him. But as soon as the show was over by October 8th, the very next day, again, I'll refer to the books here as it reads, the Whiteman Orchestra left New York on October 8th and appeared that night in Norfolk, Virginia. They would perform daily for 2 months, weekends included, and the days would follow one another in a similar way. Departure by train in the morning for a trip of a few hours, one or two shows in the destination city, one night in a hotel, and another on the train waiting for them the next morning. Bix could barely stand this endless traveling and in turn increased his alcohol consumption. Mm. Obviously. Here's a track that is taken from around that era, actually Frankie Trombauer and his orchestra, with a song called Dusky Stevedore.
Have you ever seen Dixie beneath the shining moon? Keep moving them bales away. I broke all the stitches. That means I gotta get some new britches. Move them bales away. The landlord says he's coming back. He wants the rent, else he's gonna take this yak. Now you know that ain't funny. I truly need some money. Keep on moving them bales away.
I'm just a stevedore down on the Swanee shore, working and singing a song. My dusky brow is wet, I doesn't mind the sweat, a scuffling all the day long. See my ragtime shuffling gay, happy cause I'm handling freight.
The love is heaven for this dusky stevedore,
working and singing a song.
right, of course. That is a track called Dusky Stevedore, accredited to Frankie Trambauer and his orchestra. Again, yet another day in the studio as they're crossing the country, pretty much without rest, until they finally, and Bix is actually drinking his way across the country. And what ends up happening, they finally do get a day of rest. And most of the musicians are smart enough to use it for what they could use it for. Bix actually takes the opportunity to basically drink away the entire day.
And, I think he was going to do that regardless.
Right. And I'm going to read this right from the book called The Definitive Biography of a Jazz Legend. The sudden resumption of excessive drinking had devastating effects on his tired body. On November 30th, the orchestra was featured at the New Music Hall in Cleveland. Charles Margulis had a precise recollection of that evening, a member of the orchestra. Bix had too much to drink before the concert, and he ended up passing out as we were playing. He was seated on my right, and I'm normally left-handed, so I was able to play the trumpet with my left hand and hold him upright with my right. Bix sort of snapped out of it for a moment and was uncertain of where he was and what was happening. He took a poke at me, missed, and sort of settled back into his haze. Paul Whiteman witnessed the entire incident and immediately had him hustled back to the hotel. When he reached his room at the Hotel Cleveland, Bix suffered a severe nervous crisis. His face and his body were streaming with sweat, and he was trembling, agitated, and delirious. A doctor was called. The tour had to resume, and the band left Cleveland the next morning, leaving Bix under the care of a doctor and a nurse. The events of the following weeks in the life of Bix Beiderbecke are mostly lost in the shadows, and because of the lack of recollections and documentation, dates are not cleared up. Frankie Trambauer did sadly note in his diary on the date of December 2nd, "Bix still gone. Stayed in Cleveland with DTs. I spent 4 years with him to no avail." Now, on December 14th, at the end of 1928, Bill Challis signed with the orchestration of How About Me, a tune that was to be recorded that same day, and Bix's name is not listed among the musicians selected to play this piece, so he's still not back with them. The absence gives an indication, within a few days, of the date of which Bix was admitted to the Rivercrest Sanitarium across the river in Astoria, in Queens, where Paul Whiteman had him hospitalized. The doctors diagnosed him with pneumonia, but the hospital imposed an abrupt stop on Bix's consumption of alcohol. As could be expected, though, this withdrawal brought on, after the third or fourth day of abstinence, a case of delirium tremens added to the effects of the pneumonia. This crisis resulted in severe physical trauma. The gravity of this illness kept Bix in the hospital for about 2 solid weeks. And even after his release, by the end of January, Whiteman just had to do something, so he had a replacement for Bix, a trumpeter named Andy Sechrest, who openly emulated Bix's style and copied Bix. So now he's got Bix's seat while Bix is allegedly recovering. Now, Bix returned home to his childhood bedroom in Davenport, Iowa, to regroup and heal. But the symptoms of his addiction and the resultant paranoia that it brought on only intensified. It took him until March before he finally returned to New York and resumed his place in the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. Tellingly, though, Andy Sechrest held his position. Whiteman was not going to give him up, so that was a hint. And even when recording with Frankie Trumbauer, Sechrest sat in the second trumpet chair, just to be sure, because somebody had to back up Bix, because he wasn't considered reliable at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And his time off, not playing at this point for nearly 6 months, did him no favors. His lack of confidence, his lip grew a lot weaker. Eventually, even Tram gave up, as Bix decided for himself that he was no longer playing up to his own standard. Again, reading from the book, he did not want to record with prominent names because he felt that he wasn't playing well. That alone shows how intelligent he was. He decided after April 1929 not to make any more recordings with OK Records until he felt that he was returning to his old form. And even though Bix and I were on different paths at the end of 1928, we were still closer than most people thought. Whenever there was trouble, he always found me, and I tried to help in every way possible, and that went for Whiteman, too. But when Bix departed on that voyage that was to take him out of this world, neither Whiteman nor I could have helped him. Occasionally, though, he'd come into a session, and his playing would begin to reach a par with his reputation, as on this one track that I want to play from, again, you know, late around, this is the year 1929 now, Bix appearing with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra on a track called China Boy.
Mm-hmm.
one of the popular numbers recorded by the Paul Whiteman Orchestra from 1929, which was actually becoming more of a rare thing for the Whiteman Orchestra by 1929. Of course, don't forget that there is a financial crisis that hits the country at around this time.
Mm-hmm.
And even the fortunes of this laudable orchestra began to take a precipitous drop in sales.
People didn't have the extra money.
It just wasn't there. Saving grace appeared like it would come from Hollywood and the talkies, which suddenly started. Ooh, talkies. You know, it was could have been a really big deal. And because Paul Whiteman's orchestra was still the most famous name in the country, a deal was cut with Whiteman and Universal Studios with the potential for significant income. The idea was for the entire orchestra to set off by train to Los Angeles, where they would, you know, play their way across the country. And eventually get there, and there would be a movie that they would star in featuring Paul Whiteman that would be a feature about the band. So they do this, and Bix takes off with him on the train and just mostly keeps to himself and re-intensifies his drinking. Here's like a note, actually, that was like written on the sheet music by Harry Goldfield. The Paul Whiteman Collection, which is a museum at Williams College, contains a page of sheet music. The first trumpet part of Sunrise to Sunset, which was used around May 25 through May 29. On the page, Harry Goldfield had written himself a reminder, "Wake up, Bix." Oh, you can only imagine. At this point, Bix limped. He had been feeling sharp pains in his lower limbs for several months and was having trouble walking. This reduced mobility was followed by strong nocturnal cramps, convulsive movements and shakes that disturbed his sleep. The doctors at the Rivercrest Sanitarium had quickly diagnosed a case of alcoholic polyneuritis and had informed their patient of the origins of the illness. Excessive consumption of alcohol, a progressive poisoning by products derived from faulty distillations, and a deficiency in vitamins resulting from a poor diet. Bix had clearly concentrated the risks. As his walk became more hesitant, he made use of a cane more and more often. When his friends asked why he needed the support, he said that his thigh had been cut in a brawl in a New York speakeasy. For a while, people were buying it. But for the most part, you could tell that Bix was maybe not telling the truth. And in Los Angeles, the inactivity was palpable because they got there and the script wasn't written yet. So they were getting paid to sit around, just waiting for the script to finish. So this is exaggerated by the intense schedule that they had been used to. So they go from doing so much to now they're doing absolutely nothing. They have to find places to live. The scripts are rejected. So the material and the songs were not chosen. So the band members got paid to do nothing and wait. Bix hid up in the Hollywood Hills, usually alone, and spent his time for months at this point doing nothing but drinking and sleeping. By August, after yet another rewrite was rejected, the whole process was eventually deemed to be a gigantic mistake. The entire weeks or near months of inactivity cost Universal $350,000 for the orchestra to do essentially nothing. By August 31st, 1929, the musicians were heading back to New York and back to their recording sessions. Bix ends up in the studio with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra again at this point, and they're trying to record a simple track called Waiting at the End of the Road. It took them 2 days to get a single viable take out of Bix. He's that far gone.
Wow.
On the 8th, he finally did what pretty much everybody else in the orchestra had given up on. He actually played a solo full of nuance and feeling. You could sense some emotion in it. After this take was done, Bix fainted and had to be removed from the studio.
Wow.
Here's that track called Waiting at the End of the Road.
Thank you. I've been sad, mighty sad. Louisiana, Louisiana, now I'm glad, boy, I'm glad. The whistle's blowing, the train is going, here I come, here I come. I'm tired of roaming, that's why I'm homing, back to happiness and then some. Louisiana, no place is grander, I declare, I do do declare. No skies are bluer, no friends are truer, anywhere, anywhere. Take me to your heart, give me one more start, eyes a little child, just been running wild. Louisiana, Louisiana, my own.
Waiting at the end of the road, a very significant point in Biggs's career, because after he had literally passed out after playing on that track, he was sent back home to Davenport for a second time to recover by Paul Whiteman, hoping that he would recover at least. His family at this point finally recognizes Biggs's state, acknowledges it, that alcohol is the cause of what is going on, mm-hmm. in denial up until this point. And understand, this is before alcoholism was really acknowledged as a disease or a condition.
Mm-hmm.
So the family had Biggs committed at this point into a sanitarium, committed to the Keeley Institute, actually, which was an institute that claimed that they had a formula to help drunks recover from the damage. On the entrance form, Biggs's signature is so sloppy and shaky that it's absolutely illegible. You can tell that it's a sick man who wrote this. It's broken, and it just, especially when compared to what his signature looked like a year earlier. His admittance form has Biggs himself estimating his daily intake of hard booze at 3 pints a day.
Hmm.
His stay lasted at this place for 5 weeks. He exits at almost exactly in concurrence with the stock market crash. And so as he comes out, he then finds out that all of his savings and all the money that he had been earning with Paul Whiteman is wiped out. So here he is now. He's back home, broke, recovering from an illness that he probably is not going to get over. He's sleeping in his childhood bedroom with nothing to show for his fame and his career except his exceptionally frail condition. For fun, he has some old friends from his neighborhood in Davenport who get local gigs. So he just shows up and he starts playing with them. And they can't believe, here's this national star who's showing up and sitting down and playing for $10, $15, just playing because the work in his neighborhood, these two-bit gigs with friends. And while this is happening, the Whiteman Orchestra returns to California and finishes the soundtrack for the movie that they were going to do. It's called The King of Jazz Without Biggs.
Aww.
He's not a part of it. He stays in Davenport. The year eventually falls into 1930. All this time, Biggs isn't playing. He's staying at home. He spent the spring trying to prepare for reuniting with Paul Whiteman. He's writing letters, telling him that he's recovering, almost fooling himself that he's getting better. In April, he finally does meet with his employer, hoping that he's going to get his job back. This is after a 6-month layoff now.
Wow.
Whiteman was paying Biggs this whole time, giving him a salary. But Biggs's insecurities upon meeting Whiteman made Biggs himself decide that he was not going to join up with Whiteman. Even though he wanted it more than anything, he dashes it, says, no, I can't really do it. Because one, the busy schedule intimidated him after such a long layoff. And two, there was this overwhelming amount of new material that the band had come up with in his absence. He doesn't read. So he actually is now trapped in a place where he feels that
he'll never catch up.
Never be able to catch up. So eventually, Whiteman realizes, the stock market crash hit him too, badly. The money had to stop, especially with the depression setting in. So things could not be much worse for Biggs at this point. And meanwhile, his friend, Hoagy Carmichael, mm-hmm. had managed to get pretty famous.
He had written a song called Rockin' Chair, which became a standard in jazz. He then wrote Stardust, which became one of the most well-known.
Huge.
And in my opinion, probably one of the most respectable and I think maybe one of the most beautiful melodies ever written. He did invite Bix to come to a recording session around this time to do a recording of Rocking Chair. It was his first since he was carried out of the studio 9 months earlier. And his playing on this session was promising, if not exceptional, and very sparse work. So there's really not much for me to show you in regards to how this really has very much to do with Bix or Frank or anybody else, except that it's a track by Hoagie Carmichael. So from this point, the lack of formal work led to the occasional casual jam sessions with players throwing around talk about forming a band. And Bix, because of his reputation, was offered a session with RCA. Now, this was that very, very, very last session that I was talking about that came up under his name. Now, Bix at this point is nearly delirious and beside himself, but everybody who knew Bix wanted to play on his session. So this is what went down. This is the words of Pee Wee Russell talking now. He had hired me for the date, but rather than hurt anybody's feelings, he also hired Jimmy Dorsey and Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and everybody. Every time somebody would walk into the door at Plunkett's, the bar we hung out at, Bix would say, gee, what am I going to do? So we'd go in, go up to the guy and hire him for the date. This whole thing ended up going, you know, recording for RCA. And the extent of it was that they just ended up backing a singer named Wes Vaughn. And the tracks were fairly, dull. Nothing about it that were memorable at all, I'm sorry to say. The very last recording session of his life takes place just 1 week later with the debut of a recording that Hoagie Carmichael had written. It was a new composition called Georgia on My Mind.
Mm.
If you could imagine that. The very original, if you believe it or not, the version by Hoagie Carmichael. Here it is from the very last recording session ever by Bix Beiderbecke, their version of Georgia on My Mind.
Georgia on my mind, Georgia on my mind, Georgia, Georgia, just a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still in peaceful dreams I see the road leads back to you. My Georgia, my Georgia. No peace I find, just a little song keeps Georgia on my mind. Thank you.
Obviously, a track of historic importance, the original version of Georgia on My Mind, my goodness,
yes.
With a Bix who sounds exhausted and listless, actually, on that track. But
it actually kind of suits that song.
It does. That's why it's beautiful. I agree. Well, his state actually led to pneumonia once again, which forced him home to Davenport for the third and final time of his life. His illness left him like bedridden at this point most of the time. And while he's sitting home in Davenport, January 1931, as fate would have it, the Paul Whiteman Orchestra is scheduled to come and play in Davenport, Iowa, Bix's hometown. Bix gets out of bed to go down to meet the train. And you can only imagine like how sad this event actually is, because here's Bix watching his orchestra roll into town, and Paul Whiteman greets him, shakes his hand. He even thinks that he actually looks good, because Bix does his best to put on his best presentation for it. Mm-hmm. Whiteman invites them down, and he announces from the stage that Bix is present and he's going to make an appearance with the band. So Bix approaches the bandstand and he sits down, and everybody's just waiting for him to fire up his cornet. Well, we played one of the tunes that would give Bix some solo spot, but when he stood and played, you could see the hurt in Paul Whiteman's eyes. He didn't let on, nor did any of us, but it was obvious that he just couldn't really play any longer. He would stop and look at his instrument, waiting for sound to come out of it sometimes. 26-year-old Bix started to simply recoil from life. At this point, he was actually writing a letter to his parents that says, "You probably will tear this up before you read it because you must be disgusted with me, but I'll take a chance and write anyway. You can believe me or not, but I was sick. I had that yearly attack of tonsillitis, and it was terrible lying here thinking of you. I had to cancel all those dates. And the effect of the current economic crisis weighed heavily on his parents' financial situation, and his father even wrote him a son saying how much of a burden he was. Because if I had known that it was so tough for Dad to send that, I wouldn't have asked for it. But the lack of work meant less self-pride, more time to drink, and by August 31st, 1931, pneumonia sets in again, caused by 12 years of excessive drinking. Hard to basically, you know, it took its toll. And after refusing to be hospitalized at this point and suffering from severe, violent hallucinations, Bix passes away in his apartment. Neither the New York Times nor the Chicago Tribune made any mention of his passing.
Hmm.
Born March 10th, 1903, died August 6th, 1931. Not even mentioned in the two towns that basically were the cause of all of his fame. Here's a track of, we'll end our show with a track of Bix from Much Better Days. We played a recording of this from 1924. Here's Bix at the peak of his career with Frankie Trambauer playing with him and Bix Beiderbecke and his gang from Happier Days in 1926, a track called Jazz Me Blues. Thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoyed our show, and we will be back next week.